Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Dennis Lehane, whose latest novel is World Gone By, which is, I guess, a sequel to Live by Night, which is a third volume in a series featuring the Coughlin family. Dennis Lehane has also written several mysteries in the Patrick Keane and Angela Gennaro series, also Mystic River, Shutter Island, worked on both The Wire and Boardwalk Empire, and has been working on several films, which we'll also talk about. But we're going to start with talking about these two books in particular, Live by Night and World Gone By. They tell the story of Joe Coughlin, who is a very minor character, a kid in The Given Day.
Yep.
But he grows up to be a gangster. I understand that even when you were writing The Given Day, you looked at Joe and you said in an interview, Joe was always going to be written about as a gangster, but the question was, how do I get there?
I always wanted to write a gangster novel. I knew that the time period of The Given Day was leading me to, certainly to the runway, because it ended in 1920 with the start of Prohibition. And then as I was writing that book, I was thinking, which of my characters could ultimately be that guy? And then it was about 2.5 years in, and there was a pretty dramatic scene in a sort of a dinner that went awry in the family, in the main family home. All of a sudden, I went, that's my gangster. I had a little kid, this little kid, and he was just such a victim of everything that was going on around him. And I said, he's got the emotional biography for a gangster.
But in the meantime, you did write Moonlight Mile.
I wrote Moonlight Mile after The Given Day. I'd spent 5 years in 1919. I wanted to be in a place where people had cell phones and listened to Sirius radio and that kind of thing. So I did that and then immediately went right back to writing the gangster novel that I wanted to write, which was Live by Night. And Live by Night is very much a Bildungsroman. It's a young man's coming-of-age novel. And it's just got a very rollicking energy to it. It's really the rise of a gangster. And then World Gone By picks up 10 years later and is a much more sort of August book, looking at the prices of the decisions we've made.
When you were working on Live by Night, did you know that you were, at that point, that World Gone By would be happening?
No. I had no idea. When I was working on Live by Night, I had no idea really how it was going to end. I just knew where it was going to end. I knew it was going to end in Cuba. I didn't know anything else about it.
Live by Night and World Gone By both take place mostly in Tampa and vicinity, in a place, Ybor City.
Yeah.
I did some research. Apparently, there was a kind of Joe Coughlin character named Charlie Wall. Is there any relationship at all?
No, there's no connection between Joe and Charlie Wall. Charlie Wall was a reasonably well-known gangster in the early days of Prohibition in Ybor City, but he wasn't from Boston. He was already firmly established. Joe steps into this vacuum in Ybor City in the first book that didn't exist in real life. There wasn't a vacuum. There was already a power struggle going on between Charlie Wall and Sandro Trafficante. Sandro Trafficante in this book is much more lower level. When you meet him, you hear about him in the background. The Sandro Trafficante of the actual time period was more powerful.
The mix of fiction and nonfiction reminded me a lot of what Terrence Winter did in Boardwalk Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Had Boardwalk Empire begun, I mean, you weren't involved with it in the early seasons, when you began working on Live by Night?
No, there was no connection. With Live by Night, the only thing I knew was that Boardwalk was coming. I had heard of it. I knew Martin Scorsese was going to direct the pilot. I knew that Terry Winter wrote it, and I knew that it was set in New Jersey. So I said, well, this is a good door to be closed on me, because it made me realize, well, don't do the gangster novel you think you always wanted to write. Do the one that you've never seen before. And so that made me go, I'm going to write about rum. Because normally when you think gangsters of the 1920s, you think whiskey. You think you think Detroit, Kansas City, New Jersey, Boston, New York. Rum was much more Latin flavored. It was had a much sexier feel. It was a warmer thing. And it came in from Cuba or Jamaica. And it often came in through Miami, but it also often came in through Tampa, through Ybor City, which is a section of Tampa. And so when I was sat down to write Live by Night, I said, I'm just going to write this. I remember the operating word for me every day when I was writing Live by Night was sexy. I wanted it to just be a sexy book. And the idea was to do the rum route in reverse, to start the book in Boston, have the middle section happen in Tampa, and have it end in Havana.
And at the end of Live by Night. He's a gangster in Ybor City. And then you choose to continue. Now, at the time you ended the book, at that point did you go, okay, I want to find out what happens to Joe?
Yeah. Very shortly after I finished Live by Night, I said, there's at least one more story in here, maybe more. There are other things coming. There's the Depression is coming. Then following on the heels of the Depression is World War II. Joe has stepped down from a position of power at the end of Live by Night. And it's, oh, so what's he going to do now? Because he's retiring at 27 years old. Well, what do you do then? So the book picks up with him at 37 years old. We meet him as a much slicker character. He's a consigliere now.
Way back when you were working on The Given Day, I remember I interviewed you, and you did talk about that as the first of a series of books that would deal with the 20th century.
Yeah, so I did three of them, and now I'm taking a break, and my next book is set in the present day, the one I'm writing now. And then we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see which itch comes along.
Let's go back. Most of the characters from World Gone By are in Live by Night. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about the origins of the characters, we sort of have to go back there. Once you had Joe and you figured out that this is going to be a coming-of-age story, mm-hmm. in that one, whereas I see World Gone By as a father-son story very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about a world going by. It's about middle age. It's about the moment you realize that the world you inhabited is changing irrevocably and a new order is coming in. And that's aging. That's what happens.
The other characters, Dion, his best friend, Suarez, who is not really in...
He's not really in World Gone By.
He's not in World Gone By, but he is a major character in the first book. How did these characters emerge? I mean, in particular, Dion, his good friend. You remember?
There's a line in All the Pretty Horses where Jimmy Blevins produces a gun, and John Grady Cole says to him, "Where'd you get that gun?" And he says, "The getting place." That's how I feel about characters. Where do you get your characters? The getting place. I don't know. I create one character, and then by usually necessity, they need somebody to interact with or somebody to act off of. And so Joe, in the first book, I think the first book begins, it does, it begins with him robbing the wrong place.
Right.
And so who's he robbing with? And I gave him these two brothers that he works with.
Oh, and then you ask who is he robbing, and that starts the process.
You go on and on. I usually know about three things that happen in a novel before I write it.
In World Gone By, what did you know?
I knew that there was going to be an Ash Wednesday shootout at a bakery. I had that in my head very clearly. And I knew that something terrible was going to happen in a sugarcane field. That's really it. That's really what I knew when I started the book. And I knew that I was starting, the inciting incident was, it's a fictionalized version, but it's very thinly fictionalized, was what was known as Operation Underworld, which was the first time that the U.S. government colluded with the American mafia. And this is well documented. And what happened was that we were losing tons and tons and tons, dozens of boats every month to German saboteurs. And they couldn't find these guys on the docks because they couldn't infiltrate the docks because the mafioso would smell them out and they'd beat the hell out of them and they'd send them off the docks. So Naval Intelligence cut a deal with the mafia to let their guys hang around on the docks, to let the mafia basically spy on potential German saboteurs, give them the information. And sabotage went down to zero along the American waterfront, along the entire seaboard, both sides. And the payment for that was that Charlie Luciano would be let out of prison as soon as World War II ended, which is exactly what happened.
There's also a robbery of an armaments ship by the mafia. Did anything like that happen?
That's in Live by Night. That never happened. But the thing that convinced the United States government to agree to let Luciano out, to get into this devil's agreement in the first place, was that a ship, it was in Brooklyn, actually, a ship was sabotaged by, quote, German saboteurs, unquote. And legend has always had it that Albert Anastasia and his crew did the actual sabotage to make the United States government think it was Germans.
Dennis Lehane, in order to do the research on Live by Night, you took a tour of Ybor City. You did a lot of research. Did you do that much research for World Gone By?
No. Each book in this sort of historical triptych, whatever you want to call it, I don't think of it as a trilogy because you can read the books out of order. It doesn't really matter. Each of these books was less and less research because each book was informed by the previous amount of research I did. So by the time I got to World Gone By, there's very little research to do. I did some research on Operation Underworld. I did some research on some other small things. But I had done so much research for The Given Day. And then for Live by Night, I just spent a lot of time just kind of banging around Ybor City, which I knew quite well anyway, because I went to school in Tampa, St. Pete, so I knew the area.
And Ybor City is kind of this old preserved area?
Yeah, for Florida, it's stunning, because in Florida, if the paint peels on a shopping mall, they just bulldoze it and they put up a Hooters. I mean, it's not a preservation state. But in this case, Ybor has been beautifully maintained and looks exactly as it did in 1910. It's still got a streetcar going down the middle of it. All the buildings are like red brick and wrought iron and white trim. It's as if New Orleans and Boston had a baby. That's Ybor City.
Well, it sounds great.
It's great. You should visit. If you ever go to West Central Florida, go to Ybor.
You wrote Live by Night before you worked on Boardwalk Empire.
Mm-hmm.
What happened as I read Live by Night after I watched season 4 is that I noticed that a lot of material, research material, that came from Live by Night wound up in Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, those were interesting days. There was a couple of days in the writer's room where it was always Howard Korter came up with the, he would say, what if we went to Cuba? I said, geez, Howard, where did you get that idea? I mean, it was all friendly and convivial. The book was already out. But it was a rather interesting to see my own book mined for a television show for episodes that I wasn't writing. That was interesting.
Well, you did write one episode, mm-hmm. the episode where they first go to Florida.
Yeah, but that was, I would say that wasn't heavily under my stewardship, even so.
What role did you have that season?
Well, I mean, sitting in the room and figuring out a lot of sort of macro arcs to the... But I remember I left after 3 months having figured out a lot of the sort of macro arcs. But I remember Howard Korter kept coming up with Florida and we kept going, really? And then when he got into Cuba, it was like, okay. But I wasn't there for those decisions to be made down the road. When I left, micro decisions had only been made on the first 3 episodes. Everything else was macro stuff. So it was like, this is how Nucky's going to end up. We know what's going to happen to Richard. Ultimately, we don't know how we're going to get there. Right. That kind of discussion.
What's the difference for you, Dennis Lehane? I mean, other than the fact that obviously it's a collaborative effort, but on a creative level, what's the difference between figuring out the story arc of a season of Boardwalk Empire and, say, working on the story arc of a book like World Gone By?
Hugely different, hugely. Because I was trained in TV, the only way you can write episodes in TV is to you have what are known as beat meetings. You get together and it's called beating out an episode. You figure out the 52 things that have to happen in that episode. Then if you're a producer, you're further back, you're figuring out the beats that have to happen in an entire season. I do that for TV. Whenever I write anything for TV or anything for the movies, I have to outline it first. I never outline a word of any of my novels. Never. Outside of a sort of a basic narrative spine, I believe that they share nothing in common, writing for the screen and writing for literature.
What about in terms of dialogue?
Oh, yeah, they have some of the components. But the thing is when you're writing a novel, you're writing to a reader. You're writing to somebody. It's a very intimate conversation that you're having, one-sided, but it's an intimate conversation you're having with somebody, this reader in a chair, and you're whispering to them and you're telling them a story. When you're writing a screenplay, you're like writing a schematic for 200 other people, the set designers and the director and the DP and the grips and the actors and, on and on and on. That's all you're doing. It's far less personal. You're far less invested in it. At least I am. It's a job.
When I talked to Richard Price recently, he said that working on The Wire was special because he stayed away from the suits. But by the time he got to other projects, suddenly it wasn't as much fun.
Well, I would argue, yeah, that's probably not as fun. It's way better to be the 22-year-old cashier in a bookstore who has no responsibility than the manager of that bookstore. That's, but one of them pays better. And I think, yeah, Richard has also dealt with network suits. So that's a different issue. I've never dealt with a network television show. I only deal with cable. In cable, they have a very different model. And the lunatics are allowed to run the asylum a little bit more. The different stakes. I mean, I got something right now. It's very close to either green light or death with a network, with a cable network. There's very different stakes than just sitting around a writer's room and having fun. And plus, the thing is with us on The Wire, and I think everybody will back us up on this, with The Wire, HBO, we were the lowest rated TV show on HBO. This is before the dawn of all the other cable channels. There was no AMC. There was no Mad Men. There was no Breaking Bad. There was none of that. There was just pretty much HBO. They were the only game in town when it came to original scripted TV, occasional Showtime shows. So there we are, the lowest rated TV show on HBO, and they can't find anything to replace us with. It was simple as that. They just didn't have any bullets in the holster. So they would say, oh, well, keep you on another year, you know. But they didn't really care. They didn't really, they were great. They didn't look at, as long as we didn't ask for any more money, we were left to ourselves. We were left to do almost whatever we wanted to do because nobody was watching. That was great. There was a freedom to that that, yeah, I don't think I'd ever find again.
And you wound up with what may in the end be the best show in the history of television.
So people have said, yeah. Somebody said to me yesterday, do you feel in any way responsible for the resurgence in quality in television? And I was like, what are you, high? You know, no, it's like Dave Roberts saying he was responsible for the Red Sox winning the World Series in 2008. You know what I mean? No, I was a player on the team. That was it. That was David Simon and Ed Burns' vision and HBO. They pushed that through to its pinnacle that it was in terms of, you know, television entertainment.
From what you're saying, it does have something in common with working on a novel, which is that when you're working on a novel, it's you doing what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And if you're working on a TV show where you've got more freedom than any TV show before or since, it comes down to a collaborative novel in a way.
It does. A collaborative novel, though. That's a very different thing. If I could sit in a room with six other people who would never take credit, and I could just bang out all my ideas for my novel, I would probably write three novels a year. Because the hardest part for me is all this figuring it out. Now, if you get somebody to bounce those ideas off of, that's great. But you don't, because that turns into collaboration, which is not something you do as a novelist. I don't, anyway. I don't bang my idea. I might throw an idea at somebody every now and then or say to my wife, what if so-and-so did this? But I'm not in a room with these big bulletin boards left and right and these dry erase boards trying to figure out every movement of my story.
Before we went into this room to do this interview, you mentioned that you came up with four or five different endings. You kept trying to find the right ending. We're not going to go into what that ending is. But how do you know when you're missing and how do you know when you're hitting?
I've always felt it's a strange curse/gift that I was given, and I don't know. Maybe other writers would say the same thing. I don't know. I've never discussed this with other writers. But I have this weird BS meter in me. If I'm writing inauthentically, I'm not saying at a sentence-by-sentence level. I'll still write inauthentic sentences. But I'm saying at a sort of a more global level. I will either freeze, I will block, I won't be able to write, or I'll get to the end and then I won't release it. I'll feel it. I'm not happy. I'm not giving this to anybody. My editor's not going to see this. My agent's not going to see this. That happened with World Gone By. It happened for the better part of a year. I wouldn't let it out of my hands. Everybody wanted it. I just wasn't happy with it. And then I had a conversation with another writer, and they were talking about authenticity. And that's the problem. The book ultimately is inauthentic. And that's when I completely recast the ending, and that meant going through and adding some other components to the rest of the book.
This entire story around Ash Wednesday.
Right.
You had to get from point A to whatever the ending of that would be.
Yeah, and that's the late middle of the book, and that drove me from the beginning. There's always one image that sticks with me and drives me in a book. And so with this one, I had the image of men in suits with guns clacking along sidewalks about to shoot somebody, and they had the cross of ash on their head from having gone to an Ash Wednesday service. That was the image that drove me to the middle of the book.
When you were at the beginning of the book, the two main gangsters in the book, Dion and Rico, did you have any idea what they would wind up as?
Yes, yes. Rico's name changed several times. I had a lot of trouble with his name. He had at least nine names before I finally settled on Rico DiGiacomo. But beyond that, I knew who he was. I knew what his role was in the book. I knew what was going on, certainly. The point of the book, as we start very early on, is that Joe, who is extremely successful, very much the golden boy and the golden goose. He's making everybody money. He's moving in and out effortlessly between the underworld and high society. He's the closest thing to a rock star there is in Ybor City, and he's untouchable. And he hears this rumor that doesn't seem to make any sense that somebody is planning to assassinate him on Ash Wednesday. And that drives the book because it makes no sense. But yet, no matter how little sense it makes, if somebody tells you you're going to die, you're going to take it seriously. And so he begins to investigate, and that begins to open the book up and show you this world, because he has to go from point A to point B to point C to point D to point E, and everybody keeps saying the same thing. I don't know where you're hearing this, but it, you know, there's no sense to this. But what's real, I'm really trying to get at, is this sense that, and it should be in the, it is in the book, is you can feel it in the background. Something is going on that nobody can identify. And only the people who are behind that, those machinations know. And everybody else is like a little pawn in all this. And that's Joe. Joe's a pawn in somebody else's game as the book progresses.
Dennis Lehane, in terms of maneuvering real characters with fictional characters, virtually every character in both these books is fictional, except you bring in Meyer Lansky.
Yeah. Yeah, Meyer Lansky shows up. There's a mention of Trafficante.
And there's mention of Luciano in prison.
In Live by Night, Luciano's in the book. Given to A.J., Edgar Hoover's a major character, so is Babe Ruth. You just want to have some sense of verisimilitude. You want some sense that this world actually touches on the real world. You don't want it to be just a fantasy. So if he's going back and forth to Cuba, I'm sorry, Meyer Lansky built Cuba, you know, as we understand it. He built the mob's Cuba. And what ultimately Castro tore down. It's no mistake. When the revolution happened, they set up headquarters, Castro set up headquarters in the Hotel Nacional, which was Meyer Lansky's hotel. And that was literally Castro was sending a very clear message by doing that. He was saying, we're taking over your hotel, we're taking over all the money in your casino, and there's nothing you can do about it.
The sense I get in World Gone By, it's in both books, is that Batista essentially was owned by the mob.
Oh, completely. Oh, yeah, completely. They bought and paid for Cuba. Yeah, that's just an absolute fact. That's not even a supposition. Batista was 100%, the Batista government was bought and paid for by the American mafia.
You know, people in the United States didn't see that in 59 necessarily. What they saw was, you know, eventually, though of course nobody knew what Castro was until he got into power, what they saw was just a revolution against a dictator. They didn't. I mean, unless I guess you were in the know.
No, and then, yeah, if you were in the know, you knew, and everybody knew what was going on. But what it looked like from the outside world was, oh, this is just a, here goes Cuba revolting again. I mean, they'd revolted several times over the last 100 years. But people didn't really realize what they were revolting against. I mean, the sort of difference between the haves and the have-nots was so staggering at that point. And the mafia was just making it worse and worse and worse. They chucked the mafia out.
Dennis Lehane, Given Day deals with a lot of political and social themes, and I remember in our interview we talked about comparing that era to today. Did you see that in working on World Gone By? Were you able to catch drifts of today in that book?
Yes. I wouldn't walk this too far down this conspiracy theory lane, but I do happen to agree with it. There's too many things in it that are too hard to overlook. The people who were involved in Operation Overlord, the naval intelligence and the members of the OSS who were involved in that, and the mafioso who were involved with it, which included Anastasia in New York and Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, all of those people, 20 years later, were major players around the JFK assassination. Almost every single one of their names is in the Warren Report. A lot of people believe that the collusion between the government and the U.S. mafia that began in 1942... ultimately led to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963.
There's also underpinnings of social issues like racism and sexism in those books as well.
Oh, yeah. At the end of the day, I eat, breathe, sleep, everything, I think, in terms of class. I think in terms of the haves and the have-nots. I like to say, look, in terms of the rest of the world, as little as I know about the rest of the world, America certainly seems like one of the better meritocracies, but it's not a pure meritocracy. And until we can face the issues of class and race in this country, then we're going to continue having Ferguson's, and we're going to continue having the Citizens United, and we're going to continue having this massive chasm opening up further and further and further between the haves and the have-nots. And the have-nots are going to continue to be taught to fight amongst themselves.
I mentioned before the relationship of World Gone By and the theme of father and sons. You mentioned it in terms of just middle age, but it really stretches through all these books.
Yeah, I think I write about fathers and sons. As I understand it, as I can see my own work, I write a lot about fathers and sons. I write a lot about the haves and the have-nots. And I write a lot about this concept of of family? What is family? Is family the family you're born into, or is family the family you make when you leave your biological family? What is family? And I think that becomes a constant theme throughout all of my books, or a constant question. In this, from War Gone By, Joe's got his blood. He's got Tomas. He's got Dion, his friend, who he knows it's probably not a good idea to be friends with after a certain point, but you go with them that brung you, you know? I think the added issue in this book is not that I haven't obsessed about mortality before, but I think when you have kids, and I'm an older father of very little kids, when you have kids, you begin to obsess over whether you'll be around for them. Why are you going to be there when, I don't think you obsess the same way when you're 28, but when you have kids, really young kids, and you're 48, you start thinking, will I be around for grandkids? Will I be around for all of these things? You start to think about your own mortality a lot.
When you're writing, how easy or hard is it to allow the unconscious to take over, even though you know that essentially you're dealing with your own themes? Or is it fully conscious?
It's not conscious at all. And I'm a terrible autobiographical writer. If I know what I'm writing about, then I write terribly, emotionally speaking. But I'm very good at bleak writer, I think. And when I can feel myself touching on these nerves in me, I go, I don't want to understand that. I just know I'm on the right track. And then I keep going. And so, yeah, this was a, World Gone By was a very personal book to write. But yet, I couldn't tell you why in the day-to-day. It was the first book I wrote after my own father had passed away. And I was also going through a year where I was losing a lot of people. My mother passed away. I lost a brother. There was just a lot of things making me think about a world gone by. So that just kept coming in.
And yet at the same time, you have to block it out when you're writing. You can't, right. You can't just bring it up to consciousness, and yet you're seeing it on the page.
Yeah, it'll work out. It'll get there. It'll get on the page anyway, you know. I don't obsess over themes anymore. I don't obsess over what I'm saying with a book. I get to the end and I see if it's there, and it usually is.
And if it's not, does it matter?
Yeah, go back in and put it in. You know, the first draft is just figuring out what you're writing about, in my opinion. Then you go back and you go, oh, now I know what I'm saying. Oh, that's why I left that little, you know, Easter egg for myself back there in chapter 3. You know, okay, go deal with that.
Are you ever worried about Easter eggs that don't reach fruition?
Never. Never. Those are future sequels. Whatever I want to make them. You know, that's no problem.
And you don't even know if they're Easter eggs when you put them in, or do you?
Yeah, no, you don't. No, you don't. And I like to leave some threads not tied off in everything I write, because it seems to me it's much more like life.
Dennis Lehane, Live by Night, is in pre-production, directed by Ben Affleck, who also directed Gone Baby Gone. I guess you have a relationship with him now.
We have a professional relationship. I've seen the script. It's terrific. He's been set to make it for almost 2 years now, but then every now and then, just as he's about to roll camera, somebody comes along and says, would you like to play Batman? And they back up a Brinks truck of money to him, and he says, okay. And another time it was, do you want to work with David Fincher? Okay. So actors want to act. So it's been going on for a couple of years, but as I understand it, cameras will roll this June. That's what I hear.
And you've worked on a screenplay for The Deep Blue Goodbye, John D. McDonald, with Christian Bale as Travis McGee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was involved, yes. I'm no longer involved with that. We'll see if I'm brought back in later. But I was brought in a little under 2 years ago. It was a troubled project in a lot of ways. And what I contributed, Lord knows if I'll even get credit at this point, but what I contributed without a doubt was an understanding of Travis McGee. The previous screenwriters for me, in my personal opinion as a fan and as somebody who's a big fan of those books, didn't really grasp who Travis McGee was. They got everything else. They got Florida. They got Meyer. They got all that. But they didn't get Travis McGee. So I came in and I really nailed Travis McGee. And then in the greatest Hollywood tradition, then they move you out and then they bring somebody else in to do something else. That's what they do. When you write a script for a big Hollywood production, you're just one person on an assembly line. And you do your thing. Whether it's you put the eyelets in the shoes and somebody else goes for the laces.
It's basically a day job.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fine job, and I have no complaints, and it's great, but you don't feel the same. You know, the line is, when you're a novelist, you're God. When you're a screenwriter, you're God's tailor. It's very difficult to be God, but it's also very satisfying.
And what about The Drop, which came out last year?
Mm-hmm. That was a difference. The Drop was a script that I adapted from a short story of mine, and then I later turned it into a novel. It was a really great circle on that project. But that was just a really a labor of love for everybody involved. We had a wonderful director, Mikhail Roskam. We had a terrific cast with Tom Hardy and James Gandolfini and Noomi Rapace. And it was a joy to work on that. And we did a very low budget, very gritty, very early 1970s influenced film. And we're all very happy with it, except I think for the accountants.
Dennis Lehane, what is Silk Road?
Something I'm no longer associated with.
Okay.
So, yeah. No problem. Yeah. No, it just didn't work out. I was supposed to do it. It was based on that guy, the Dread Pirate Roberts, the guy who got caught doing the Bitcoin scam. The project finally crossed my desk. It banged against another project. I couldn't do it.
Wikipedia also says something about a remake of A Prophet.
Yeah, I did the American remake of a great film called The Prophet, which is a French film from, I believe, 2009.
Great film.
A real masterpiece. And so I did the remake. I don't think there's any place for me to go but down because the film's so good. But I did what I could, and right now I know there's a director and a movie star circling that right now, but I don't know, no further details after that.
Did you have any influence on Scorsese with Shutter Island?
Influence on Scorsese?
Let me rephrase that. What was your relationship to the film version of Shutter Island?
Oh, it was a strong consulting relationship. But, you know, people say, well, so what did you say to Martin Scorsese? Nothing. Hi, how are you, Marty? Glad to see you. It's not like you're going to sit there and say to Marty, ooh, I think the camera should maybe go over there, you know? No, once you bring in somebody of that power and that genius, you just get the hell out of their way.
Do you find it easier or harder to adapt your own material or other people's? I know Donna Westlake once said it's very easy to adapt other people or fun, but your own stuff is a little bit too close to home.
Yeah, absolutely. The only time I've ever adapted my own work was Animal Rescue, which was a short story that I turned into The Drop. That's extrapolating, moving outward. To move inward, to cut a book, I would be the last person to trust. I have no perspective. I wouldn't know what 80% to toss out of Mystic River to make a good movie. Brian Helgeland did. And I bet if you handed me somebody else's book and I could be completely, you know, merciless, I would know what to cut. But I don't have the perspective for my own work. It's like asking a surgeon to operate on their own child.
As someone who writes for Hollywood and writes your novels, if someone takes out an option on one of your books, are you better able to let it go because you know how the system works, or is there the same angst that any writer would feel, do you think?
Oh, no. I've had a very different playbook since the beginning. I don't let just anybody take out an option on my books. That's the only place I control it. So I'm terrible to deal with in the early stage. If I don't want to sell to you, I don't want to sell to you. I don't care if you get deep pockets. I really don't care. I only sell to people whose work I respect. I don't sell directly to studios. I only sell directly to the talent, the writer, director combo, or a producer whose work I really respect. I do not sell. I wouldn't sell something directly to Warners without knowing who they were going to give it to. Because after that, it is out of your hands. So you should have total faith in the people you hand it to. So I handed it to Clint Eastwood. I handed it to Alan Ladd and Ben Affleck. I handed it to Mike Medavoy, who then got Martin Scorsese. These are people whose work I really respected. And from that point, you just hope it all works out. But you're not terrified. You're not sitting there going, what are they going to do to it? Which bean counters are going to come in? Which suits are going to walk through the door and screw this up? Because no suit tells Martin Scorsese anything. So you have to worry about that. You know, no suit tells Clint Eastwood anything. And Ben Affleck had Alan Ladd behind him, and Alan Ladd was not in a position where anybody was going to tell him anything. So that's who you get involved with.
And at this point, I would think Affleck is starting to get to a position now.
He's beyond it. He's the hottest. I think he's right now he's certainly the hottest, quote, new director in Hollywood. He can do whatever he wants.
Dennis Lehane, do you see yourself going back to Patrick Kensey and Angela Gennaro again?
I don't see anything beyond the next book right now. I may. Be great. I may not. I don't know. I go literally book to book to book. I never have anything planned.
But you are planning, perhaps, to go back to the Coughlin family?
No, I don't know. I have no idea. There's no immediate plans. My next book is set in 2008. I have no immediate plans beyond that.
How many projects are you working on right now? A number.
That's an interesting answer. There's not a simple answer to that. I have a book. I'm writing a book right now. I have three TV projects in various stages of development, and then I have these two scripts that we already discussed that are out there that are going in various stages of production or pre-production. That's for six.
Does the day job keep you from doing the night job?
Oh, no. That's my day job. Writing the books is my day job. I get to my office every morning. Me and my insane dog get to my office by 7:30 in the morning. I work until, all told, about 4 o'clock, and then I go back and I'm with my family, and I just get up and do it again.
And the other work is just...
Well, the other work may come in the afternoon if I have to do retouches, but what I don't do is... I'm not working on a script per se right now. I may be doing retouches. I may be doing another quick polish on something, but I am not, like, writing a script. I'm writing my book right now. When I finish writing my book, I will take a script job, but not until then.
You've been listening to an interview with Dennis Lehane, whose latest novel is titled World Gone By. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Special thanks to Elaine Petrocelli and the folks at Book Passage Bookstore in Corte Madera, California, where this interview was recorded.